Welcome to Lifelines Radio. I'm your host, Maria Gallagher, Legislative Director of the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation. Joining me today is Laura Echevarria, Director of Communications and Press Secretary for National Right to Life. Welcome, Laura.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's good to be with you. Now, Laura, tell me, where were you and what was your reaction when you heard the news that Roe versus Wade had been overturned?
I was at our convention in Atlanta, Georgia, and we were in the press room, and we were watching the results coming from the Supreme Court. And as you were aware, I'm not sure if your listeners are, you never know when a decision's going to come down. You know that the court has certain days of the week that they're going to release decisions, but you have no earthly idea when one that you are interested in is going to be released, when they're going to release a decision. And so we had to watch. Every time the court said, today we're going to be releasing decisions, we had to be right on the computer at 10 a.m. when they started releasing them. And they released them around every 8 minutes. And so we had gotten their computers up in the press room, and we were waiting, and we were watching a particular website. There's a wonderful website called SCOTUS Blog that does a nice job with commentary and putting links up as quickly as the court releases the decisions. Then SCOTUS Blog has them up, and sometimes it's faster, actually, than waiting on the Supreme Court's website. And so we were watching, and as soon as it hit, and we had a decision. First of all, your first thought is shock for just a moment because you don't expect that actually to happen. And then I jumped up and yelled, we have a decision. And then I had to run from one side of the hotel to the other because I had to do a press release, and it was pretty much ready to go, but I had to get our executive director and our general counsel and everybody together in the same room so that they could review what had been what had been handed down and what the decision said before we sent out the press release. So it was a combination of just shock and being stunned that we actually had a decision and that it had come down during the convention because we thought it might be another week. And then just pure adrenaline after that, making sure it got done. But I have to admit that when all that hit, I got everyone together in the same room and we were trying to finalize the press release and I was trying to type, my hands started shaking. Because you realize the historical significance of it and you also realize that your job just increased, you know, many, many times over. Because now we were dealing with state-by-state battles when it comes to protecting human lives.
I was there, too, at the National Right to Life Convention when the decision came down, and it was really electrifying, and it also brought tears to my eyes. And I remember going up to different people at National Right to Life and thanking them for all the work that they had contributed to that milestone day, and you certainly were part of that, so I want to thank you publicly for what you did to help make that happen.
Thank you.
Laura, what drew you to pro-life work to begin with?
It was an ongoing process. I grew up in a conservative Christian home, and my parents, of course, with that, they were opposed to abortion. I remember vague recollections of my mom being upset when they handed down the decision in 1973. But I was a small child. I was five when that happened, or not quite five when that came down. And so I only have vague recollections of the impressions my parents left with me. Both of my parents were not happy with the decision. When I was older, I discovered, for example, that my youth director at church, he had been born as the result of a rape. He had been conceived in the process and because of a rape. And so he had very strong opinions about the issue. And I realized also the influence he had on my life. And if he had been aborted, he would not have been there as a teacher and somebody who had an impact not just on me but all the teens in the youth group. And then when I got to college, I had a professor. I went to a conservative Christian University, and I had a professor who was actively involved with a local pregnancy center, and so I saw the work that she was doing. And then I think for me, getting involved really hinged on a couple of moments. We had two young women at our church who were friends of mine, and one of them, or both of them, came to me and said, "I think I'm pregnant." And it turned out that one of them was not, but the other one was. And she was in a situation where the father of the baby suddenly was denying that he was the father. He was telling all of his friends that. He was her first boyfriend. And so she felt she was devastated. She was scared. And one of the first things out of her mouth after she explained all this, in the midst of all of her tears, was, "I think I'm going to have an abortion." And my first response, and my sister was there with us when this happened, you know, both of us immediately, you know, our first response was, "No, absolutely not. We are going to do whatever we need to do to help you through this." And we kept that promise, and she had her baby. And today, she's actually the mother of a few children, but that daughter just recently had a baby. And so she is now a grandmother because of the daughter that she gave birth to. So it had a huge impact, but specifically working for National Right to Life, that came about because I was working at a radio station, and over the fax machine, yes, way back then, over a fax machine came a fax from National Right to Life. This was back in 1994, and a fax came over the machine. It was just a press release, but I looked at it, and I remember thinking, this would be a really great group to work for. And I sent a couple of resumes in, and there were no openings at the time. But later, there was an opening, and I got a phone call, and that's what started it. And I worked for National Right to Life from 94 to 2004 until the birth of my third child. And then a few years ago, I was asked to come back as the communications director.
So wonderful. Now, we have a new U.S. House of Representatives with a new life-affirming agenda. What is the significance of the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which recently passed the House?
That was a huge accomplishment, a huge victory for us. Nancy Pelosi, when she was Speaker, denied that coming to the floor for a vote 80 times. 80 separate times they tried to bring that to the floor for a vote, and 80 times Nancy Pelosi denied it. The significance of it, the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, requires any attending physician, when a baby is born alive following an abortion, so if the intent is an abortion but the baby is born alive, the baby is at that point in time considered a neonate. And so we're dealing with a newborn baby, regardless of how old the baby is. This law would require the attending physician and the medical personnel present to make sure that that baby receives the same care and life-sustaining treatment that any other baby born at the same gestational age would receive. And so it requires positive life-affirming action, regardless of what the intention was, that the baby was supposed to be aborted, makes no difference, and that makes it clear that at that point in time you're dealing with a baby, and any actions that take place that would cause the death of a child after it's been born, after he or she has been born, would be infanticide. And so at that point in time, medical personnel are supposed to jump in and do everything they can to make sure that child is treated and taken to a local hospital for further treatment, because of the fact that at that point in time, we're dealing with a living human being who is separate from his or her mother, and the fact that the baby was supposed to be aborted no longer is relevant in that case.
The Biden administration has been working to expand dangerous chemical abortions. Why are such policies a threat to the health and safety of women?
The abortion method that you are talking about is the combination of mifepristone, which some of your listeners may remember it as RU-46. That was the name that it was given when it was first created back in the late 1990s. Actually, I think it was created earlier than that, but when we started hearing about it was in the 90s. And now it's known by its generic name, mifepristone. And then there's a second drug, misoprostol, that is given to women, and they cause an abortion early in the pregnancy. The FDA has determined that you can't be past 10 weeks for the abortion drugs to work. But chemical abortions are dangerous for women. We know that under controlled circumstances, with studies and things, you know, during studies where they track the women and they know what's going on and they know exactly what the dosage was and when the women took them and things like that, we know that approximately 5% of women who take the drugs are going to end up in the emergency room. And then there was a recent Canadian study that was done, and again, they track women who end up in the emergency room and why, because Canada has a healthcare system, a universal healthcare system, and so they tracked it, and it was a 10% figure that the 10% of the women who took the drugs ended up in the emergency room. To extrapolate that out, we're looking at approximately 930,000 abortions a year. On average. And from that number, the vast majority of them take place very early in the pregnancy, within the first month of pregnancy. So just using those numbers, and this is going to be a very general figure, if you take 5% of that number, of half of them, because half of the abortions that are being done today, about 54%, 53.4%, are being done using the chemical abortion method. So if you extrapolate out from that, you're looking at 5% of 930,000 as being somewhere close to 20,000 women. If you use the Canadian percentage, you're looking at close to 40,000 women ending up in the emergency room. And those are for severe circumstances, that in that they end up in the emergency room because of severe hemorrhaging. Some of those women are going to need transfusions as a result of the hemorrhaging. So this is not someone's going to the emergency room with some pain. The procedure itself is extremely painful and causes severe hemorrhaging and already causes severe bleeding, but you're talking about women who end up in the emergency room as a result of these effects of the drugs. So you're talking about a drug combination that is given to a healthy mother of a healthy baby who goes into the emergency room because she took medication to kill her child. And understanding those side effects and the very real possibility that a woman can end up in the emergency room is part of the education that we are trying to get out there to the general public so that they understand that this is not an easy process and that a baby does die and that the mother could die.
Can you give additional examples of how the Biden administration is extreme when it comes to the issue of abortion?
Oh, my. Well, first of all, the Biden administration, out of everything that this president has done, with regard to abortion issues, one of the very few things, in fact, from my understanding, is one of only two things that he has called at some point an all-of-government approach has been the abortion issue. The only other thing that he has used that phrase regarding has been climate issues. But the other issue has been the abortion issue. And this administration has been lockstep with the abortion industry on pretty much anything they want to do that's on their wish list. This administration has been, you know, hand and glove with them to get it done. So some of the things that they have tried to do or have done have to do with, for example, mifepristone. The administration, Biden actually right now has demanded the FDA review whether or not they can send the drugs through the mail into states that currently have laws saying that the drugs are illegal in that state. He wants the FDA to research all this and get back, you know, to the administration, get back with answers within 60 days. He just made that announcement recently. So they're, right now they're probably 54 days into this 60 days. And then Mexico City policy, he reversed that. That was one of the very first things that he did coming into office. Mexico City policy prevents tax funds that are given to organizations you know, charity organizations and so forth around, you know, to do things globally, it prevents those monies from going to organizations that perform or promote or lobby to change abortion laws in other countries. And he reversed that law. They have promoted the Women's Health Protection Act, and that would, it goes beyond just codifying Roe. It's much more expansive, and it really would entrench abortion as the law of the land, and that somebody could get an abortion for any reason at any time. And that was the case under Roe, but this would sweep nationally, and it would be a federal law that would be in place. And then funding of abortion providers. The President's Health and Human Services Department overturned the Trump administration's Protect Life rule, and that was part of the Mexico City policy. But this was, under President Trump, this had been broadened, and this meant that Title X funding could be given to abortion facilities that perform or promote or refer for abortions. And so that means that funding for Planned Parenthood was reinstated. Funding for abortion facilities, whether they are separate or they are co-located with a facility that handles family planning and so forth, if the abortion facility is right there, if they share the facility, it doesn't matter. Under this administration, the funding can go to either. This administration does not make a distinction, and they're more than happy to fund Planned Parenthood. And so there are a number of things. There was abortion funding in the military. This president has appointed ideologues in positions of power within his administration. These are individuals who are absolutely committed to abortion on demand. Xavier Becerra, for example, heads up the Health and Human Services. And so Javier Becerra is one of them. He has no experience in the medical field. He's married to a doctor, but she also is an abortion advocate. But that is his closest link to any kind of medical background. But he's heading up Health and Human Services because he was appointed as, you know, as somebody with this kind of ideology. So he's just an example. The vice president on Sunday spoke in Florida, and this administration has been very, very opposed to the Dobbs decision and has been promoting chemical abortions. And so Vice President Kamala Harris was in Florida, and she spoke down there. And when she did, she was quoting the Declaration of Independence somewhat and realized, I guess, that you can't say the Declaration of Independence ensures the right to life if you are opposed to the right to life. So she actually dropped that part of the quote when she was referring to it, and it certainly made the press that she did not include the right to life, that life being the first right, she completely glossed over it and didn't even mention it. So this administration really has made this a priority. This is one of their very, very top priorities.
You're listening to Lifelines Radio, produced by JMJ Radio. I'm your host, Maria Gallagher. Today, we are talking with Laura Echevarria of National Right to Life. Laura, National Right to Life recently produced a report on the state of abortion in the U.S. What are some of the highlights of that report?
It is a tremendous, tremendous resource, and I have to give all the credit goes to Derek Jones. He is our development director, and he started doing this a decade ago, putting this together as a resource. And it is a fantastic resource, not just for reporters and legislators, but also for pro-life groups. We produce it every year in January. It comes out, and this one is the biggest one we've ever done. It's 84 pages, and it contains the latest in abortion statistics. It contains information about the latest laws that have been both passed, pro-life laws have been passed, and also pro-abortion pieces of legislation that have either been attempted or passed. It contains charts and numbers regarding state laws and what kind of state laws are out there, protective legislation. There is also information about major Supreme Court decisions that have been handed down over the years regarding the life issue. And there's also a wonderful resource, a very thorough resource on the Equal Rights Amendment, because that is something else that we are still engaged in as well.
Do you believe that many people simply don't realize that there have been more than 64 million abortions in the U.S. since 1973?
I think that that number, two things. First being that I think that that's not something that people are aware of. I don't know if that's what many people pay attention to. They don't necessarily track the number. And I think when even when people do hear the number, it's such a large number, it's very difficult for people to comprehend just how big that is. And so one of the things that we have used in social media is showing the population of certain segments of the United States and blacking out part of the United States and showing what the population is and how that figure compares to the number of babies who have been aborted since 1973. It's a very large figure for people to comprehend.
Definitely. Now, why does education remain such a vital part of the pro-life movement, even in the wake of the Dobbs Supreme Court decision?
It is vitally important. Our opposition on this, the abortion groups, they will mislead, misinform, deceptively present information. That is so common for them to do that. And the press very often doesn't call them on it. They are not questioned about it. They just present it. And, of course, we've all heard the expression that you repeat a lie often enough, eventually it becomes the truth. And so that's something that we are dealing with. One of the challenges that we're facing is overcoming misinformation that came out from the abortion industry that women would not be able to get treatment if, for example, they had a miscarriage and they went to the emergency room, that miscarriages, it would be questionable whether or not they could be treated in the emergency room, completely ignoring the fact that in a miscarriage, the baby has died. And so you're no longer talking about a living human being. You're talking about a child who has died in utero, and a woman should, and it should get treatment, and it is medical malpractice not to treat a woman who has had a miscarriage. The same arguments they presented also, they use the same arguments for ectopic pregnancies. An ectopic pregnancy is a life-threatening situation, and a woman needs to be treated, has to be treated in order to save her life. But this doesn't matter to the abortion industry. They're just concerned with getting their way on this issue, and regardless of whether or not they're telling the truth. And so education will and continues to play an absolutely vital role, even post-Dobbs.
It has been said that pro-life laws save lives. Can you explain how that is the case?
Pro-life laws do. For example, I'm going to use my home state of Virginia as an example. In Virginia, we had a law that required a young woman to have an ultrasound before an abortion and that she be given the opportunity to see that ultrasound. That, in and of itself, many of the pregnancy centers today offer free ultrasounds, and so that gave her the opportunity to see her child, but also gives pregnancy centers the opportunity to offer something to a young woman who is facing a decision about whether or not she thinks she needs an abortion, or she thinks that that's her only option. And so it gives them an opportunity to present truth to her. And so we had this law on the books until we just elected a pro-life governor recently. But before that, we had a pro-abortion governor, and a lot of these laws were swept off the books. And when that happens, you no longer have that draw to bring a young woman in because she doesn't have to have an ultrasound, not any longer. And so it does have a tremendous impact when you can get legislation passed that allows you to educate, but also allows you or gives you the opportunity to present truth and information, you know, informational facts to a young woman facing a decision that's going to change her life and certainly take the life of her child.
In the couple of minutes we have left, can you talk about how can we make abortion unthinkable?
I think for this post-Dobbs era, the way we make it unthinkable is that we provide safety nets for women. I think that's going to be something that between pregnancy centers and legislators, we're going to have to come up with safety nets and ways of making sure women have their needs met. I don't think it's very rare to hear of the young woman, and usually it's an activist who is excited or was excited that she got to have an abortion. Young women who go to an abortion facility do it under distress and under circumstances where they think they should, they don't have the support or the means of taking care of their child. And so it is a stressful situation, and they don't really want it, but they feel like it's their only choice. And that's not a choice.
How can people learn more about National Right to Life and its mission?
I think if they are interested, they can certainly visit our website, and that's www.nrlc.org, and they can certainly check out what's on our website. And if they're interested, we have a state affiliate in every state, and they can become more involved on the state level and also at one of our many chapters that exist in each state. So certainly there are ways for them to become involved, but volunteer. I would just say volunteer. We can use your talents and your abilities.
We have just about 30 seconds left. Can you tell me, do you believe 2024 will be a critical year for the pro-life movement in the U.S.?
Yes, I think so. We're going to see a lot of changes. We're going to see a lot of legislation. I know that our state legislative director said she's already received over 1,000 alerts, which would be 1,000 different kinds of legislation that are being presented on the state level. So we're excited about what we are going to be able to do to protect unborn babies and their mothers.
Laura Echevarria, Director of Communications and Press Secretary for National Right to Life, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Lifelines Radio, a production of the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation and JMJ Radio. I'm your host, Maria Gallagher, Legislative Director of the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation. Thank you so much for joining us. And remember, there is always a reason to choose life.